Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I'm joined by Harry.
Hello.
And I'm Josh. And we are going to be talking about libertarianism today. And obviously, I'm not going to be able to cover everything about libertarianism. I mean, it's just going to be a slight window, and I'm going to address some of the criticisms because I've seen lots of criticisms of libertarianism from the kind of conservative right, and particularly Americans who are traditional conservatives, that I think might be a bit unfair. I'd like to address some of them, and I think that you've certainly read very widely from lots of libertarian-inclined authors, and I think that you'll have lots of interesting things to say.
Yes.
And I myself... I identify as libertarian. I've got libertarian leanings, but I'm not like a traditional libertarian, I suppose.
You're not dogmatic and mental. Like
no.
Very many of them can be. I'll just preface this by saying that I used to consider myself a libertarian, but not anymore. Mm-hmm. At some point during the past few months, I found myself drifting away from that, and I found myself on a course that I'm describing now as drifting ever rightwards. I've sort of gotten away from the libertarian mindset, which I think has some merits, mm-hmm. but I think also has some major pitfalls to it.
I imagine you're still quite liberty inclined, though. It's not that abandoned the concept of freedom or anything.
Of course not. I think it's just that libertarianism, and I'm sure we'll get into this as we go along, mm-hmm. tends to be quite maniacally focused purely on liberty to the mm-hmm. detriment of other aspects of life or other moral foundations, to use the Haidt term, that can get thrown to the wayside in this kind of blinkered, all-consuming pursuit of just pure liberty. And that's where, as we get along, I'm sure you've probably set aside something to do with the ANCAPs.
I'm going to mention them in passing, but I feel like they're a distinct enough group that they deserve
themselves the kind of vanguards of pure libertarianism. They mm-hmm. consider themselves to be the purists, whereas everybody else is some variation of statist. So
yeah.
they're very much libertarian in that whole sphere, and they... I don't know if to mention it now or later, but I'll mention it now because I just want to get it out there. Through reading Rothbard, I found that, I don't know if other libertarians do this, but Rothbard in particular is pretty bad for it, because I think you're reading for A New Liberty at the moment, the Libertarian Manifesto. Mm-hmm.
Not very far for it, to be honest. I got a bit distracted.
I've read it in the past, and especially when he talks about historical examples, Rothbard has this terrible, terrible habit of any time there is a writer, thinker, political leader who at any point in their career mentioned liberty as a topic of discussion that they wanted to focus on, basically just goes, famous libertarian author, famous libertarian writer. He just likes to throw it out there and label them as such, including people like, I mean, you could make the argument that Thomas Jefferson, for instance, was definitely a classical liberal
yeah.
of his time. But Rothbard goes further and calls him a libertarian, not even like a proto-libertarian, just
I think
goes straight out there and then seemingly ignores some of the more statist-inclined things that Jefferson did and said towards later on in his life, for instance, in his presidency. And then when he was speaking, I think it was in 1812 during the war with France, he was talking about how they needed to use protectionist tariffs to maintain and protect
That's
industry.
Very anti-libertarian.
Yeah, so I find that some of them can pick and choose and mm-hmm. cherry-pick examples from writers that they want mm-hmm. to do to show it as being a lineage and mindset and set of beliefs that goes back further along than I think it does. Obviously, there's a massive continuity between libertarianism and classical liberalism.
But obviously, libertarianism has its origins in classical liberalism.
Yes.
And I would say that classical liberalism is the more state-oriented version of libertarianism, maybe. It's the kind of upper bound before you get out of it.
Yeah, it's kind of a grey area where one ends and the mm-hmm. other begins. Like, you could claim that somebody like Robert Nozick is a libertarian, but at the same time, he supports the state, or at least a very small version of the state, and you ask
yourself...
Well,
that is a libertarian, isn't it? Well I'm going to get on to the actual definition.
We'll get into it.
Mm-hmm. But I've got a little summary written that I'm just going to read out to give you a bit of background, because we've been talking about libertarianism quite a lot, but it's good to give it a little summary. So libertarianism is a political philosophy that advocates for individual liberty and minimal government intervention in people's personal and economic affairs. It is rooted in classical liberal ideas that emerged during the Enlightenment period of the 18th century. One of the earliest proponents of libertarian ideas was the English philosopher John Locke, who argued in favour of natural rights and limited government. In the 19th century, libertarian ideas were further developed by philosophers like John Stuart Mill, Herbert Spencer, and were embraced by some classical liberal political parties. However, it's not really had much of a mainstream popularity, really. In the 20th century, libertarianism was influenced mostly by economists, people like Hayek, Milton Friedman. They were the more sort of mainstream, but also you've got people like Mises, Rothbard, who are more libertarian.
There is definitely a few branches and strains of libertarianism.
People talk about it like it's some sort of monolith, that like everyone agrees, but I find that even though I'm very much liberty inclined, many other libertarians really get on my nerves. Like, objectivist libertarians are absolutely insane.
Yes. That's born from the fact that Ayn Rand herself had a very fractured and inconsistent philosophy. Mm-hmm. I know that objectivism itself kind of was not a stated written doctrine, but was more inferred through a lot of the metaphors and a lot of the writings that she did. You kind of had to extract the principles. So it's actually, I think, Leonard Peikoff ended up writing the book on what the objectivist principles are, because Ayn Rand refused to do that. So he was like, fine, I'll just read all of your stuff and take what the actual principles are out of that. And then everybody who knew her, including somebody like Rothbard, says that Rand was incredibly changeable. So she would say one thing one day, and this is the new objectivist doctrine, and you're not allowed to go away from it or else we'll kick you out of the group. She was very, very fond of excommunicating people. And then all of a sudden the next day she says, I've realized the exact opposite is the case. So everybody doing what I said to you yesterday, be careful or you're out. She was very changeable. She seemed very inconsistent. Obviously, there were a few things that she was very consistent on, and she had a few good points to make. But the fact that it was so illogical almost makes objectivists inherently nutty.
Yeah, it's something that's worth knowing about, and you can identify some of the good ideas and some of the bad ones. Like, she was very good talking about things like the welfare state. She's saying, yeah, this isn't good. This is really bad for society. And I think that attitude was vindicated, because she was saying this in like the late 50s, early 60s. She's just like, yeah, the welfare state's going to destroy America. And I mean...
Yeah, I mean...
Is that wrong?
Basically, everybody who was predicting things to do with the welfare state going south back then was absolutely vindicated with time. Mm-hmm. It's just a shame that nobody listened to them at the time, although I don't think the politicians would have wanted to listen to them anyway, because of the fact that the welfare state helps to centralize and maintain power.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go through some of the common fundamental principles that I've identified. Obviously, these are my opinion, and it's not necessarily true of everyone, but I've tried to find things that are shared amongst all libertarians, just so you can get a rough idea of what all of the different strands, which we're going to go through in a second, have in common. So I think most define liberty as freedom to do whatever one wishes as long as one respects others' rights. I think that's a fair definition, more or less, although people like myself, who are a bit more socially conservative, might say, well, you still have society picking up the slack for where government lets up, in that people would be policed by each other socially rather than forced by the state, which is effectively forced by violence to conform to certain standards. So people might be shamed or shunned if they do something that's too taboo. And I think that this goes on today anyway. It's not like it's something that needs to be introduced. And when you have greater personal responsibility, this is only going to pick up more. And I feel like this is quite an uncontroversial aspect, because this is something that is inherent to human nature, and we do already, but I think we could actually use it to enforce standards that I think people are more likely to actually listen to as well. Because it's one thing to have something demanded by the government, but then it's another thing to have people around you say it, because it's pretty easy to disregard what the government says, or at least been my experience.
For a lot, I think COVID showed that most people, when push comes to shove, are happy to go along with government mandates, if that's what happened. And what you're talking about here, obviously, excuse me, I feel the same, that most moral obligations should be socially enforced, because we still, whether or not you want to include the government in the equation, we still have social obligations to one another.
Absolutely.
One of the things that surrounds people who live a good life is that they have other people around them living good lives, that kind of reinforces itself. It's like a nice cycle. But I would say, doing some reading, I think that, especially after COVID, it's become clear to me that a lot of what we consider culture has been been enforced through things like legislation and through things like government mandates, and people adapt around them, learn to get along with them, and then socially enforce from there once it's already ingrained. So, for instance, I always bring it up recently because it's a fantastic book, The Age of Entitlement by Christopher Caldwell, spoke about how the government used civil rights legislation, and you can make the argument, especially when you start to look into the civil rights movement, a lot of it was funded by some pretty shady characters, funded by some people with lots and lots of money, people like Nelson Rockefeller, who was a member of the Rockefeller family, so immediately you should be on guard and not trusting this person. After all, his father or grandfather, David Rockefeller, helped set up the Fed, the Federal Reserve, in the first place. So not a family to be trusted, not one that you should expect to be wanting to decentralize government power either. He was funding Martin Luther King, despite the fact that he was a Republican, but this was back when the Republicans and the Democrats kind of were mixed parties, or at least certainly much more so than they are now. So Nelson Rockefeller funded this and then helps to get the legislation passed through. There were lots of other groups doing the same thing that all wanted to get benefits from this. And then the legislation, the Civil Rights Act and the legislation that came after it, ended up creating a legal situation where it took a few decades to get hold properly, but it ended up creating a legal situation where most people, the behaviors that were normal to them before, say, for instance, hiring practices where you don't have to hire a certain amount of black people, and speech like the behavior and the kind of speech that you use, all of a sudden start to get policed more and more, not necessarily because it's a natural occurrence within the social group that you're part of, but because people recognize the changes, the way that we see with wokeism nowadays. A lot of people who I know who 10 years ago were completely normal people have got pronouns in their bio, they tone police, they police pronouns if you start talking about people, if you make any mention of anything to do with, say, like, for instance, gay marriage or anything like that. These people freak, and this is not a natural occurrence. This is not because bottom-up society has changed organically in such a way. It's because of the fact that people recognize the social enforcement mechanisms changing around them, including just potentially being fired from your job, getting fined by the government, all these things, and they change their behavior accordingly. So I do think that, as much as I would like for it to be more of an organic, natural thing, the standards that we enforce, I think for the first part, at least, and this is going to make me sound like a bit of a social engineer, but only because everyone around me has been socially engineered to the point that we are right now, I think at first you will probably need some kind of legislation, or at least the removal of the legislation that we have at the moment, and some policies encouraging more wholesome behavior, not necessarily prescribing things and not necessarily punishing things, more policies in the way that people recommend, like in Hungary they have the policies to encourage parents having children, something like that, something that offers benefits to people for behaving in a certain way rather than penalizing people.
More carrot than stick.
Yeah, more carrot than stick, that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, and obviously I don't disagree that the government and law influence people's attitudes. That's pretty undeniable, and you used a very good example for it. But I think that quite often we look at the issue in a way, not saying that you do necessarily, but we look at the issue as in it being a single direction, in that it's all top down. But I think that it's a lot more complicated than in that there's exchange where society changes and then the laws follow suit and vice versa. I think there's more of a bi-directional relationship between the two, because how are you going to get the ideas for the government in the first place if they're not already circulating in the society?
Well, I agree with that, but to bring in some elite theory
Okay, of course.
A little bit. Those tend to come not from necessarily the people, so to speak, but from opposing centers of power. So other elite groups combating other elite groups force each other to make compromises and change
things. I mean, societal elites are the ones that generate the ideas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're, say, at a university, you could be classified as an elite, and they're the ones that are trying to push the forefronts of knowledge or regress it in many cases, depending on which department they're in. But I think that it's a complicated relationship, and government can be used to change attitudes. But then there's also the example of, we don't agree with the government, even though we've gone for our whole lives effectively trying to be programmed by the government to behave like good citizens. And if anything, I've become more and more disaffected with the government message as I've gotten older, rather than more and more influenced by it. So it goes to show that there are certain people are independently minded and can't be influenced. And I would argue, this is perhaps my own personal bias here, that people who go along with the whims of the government are conformists by nature, and therefore they're always going to conform to something, and it's just a matter of getting the right thing.
Well, I think
it's a sort of personality disposition rather than it being something that can affect every single person.
I think most people tend to be quite conformist by nature. For the most part, people are willing to go along to get along. You know, most people just want an easy life. But it's when we get to the extremes that we've experienced in more recent years, where all of a sudden the government is enforcing things like transgender ideology and encouraging policies and positions that will inevitably lead to more people's children potentially castrating themselves and going through these irreversible surgeries without having to get the parents' permission first. That's when you suddenly start to come up against the edges of how far you can push people before they turn. And I think those people like ourselves, who are naturally a bit less conformist, who want to explore and discover other ideas, who aren't afraid to go outside the boundaries of the Overton window, an acceptable discussion.
I'm sure many of the audience are that way.
Yes, of course, the audience as well. I'm sure that's where these opposing elite power centres can emerge if we start to politically organise in such a way.
And I think the transgender example is actually a good example of something where I think government is necessary, because if some of the more extreme libertarians, I feel like extreme is probably not the right word, but the more...
I think radical is a term that they would actually happily accept.
Okay, the ones who would say, okay, any government intervention is bad, this is where I would disagree with them, because I would say, well, protecting the rights of children from potential parental abuse is somewhere where government should step in to defend the rights of the children, right?
And if we go on further, this will be a point that I bring up when I think we'll carry on with the document in a moment, but just to lay the seeds for it. So I generally see that there are two kinds of libertarian, or at least two strains of major libertarianism, that can intermingle with each other. But when you get one who's on entirely one side and entirely on the other side, that's when you tend to get the crazies, or at least the crazy ideas banded about, because Rothbard was definitely purely one side, and he wasn't crazy per se, but he did put some crazy ideas forward. And those two strains are the economic efficiency libertarianism, where you have people like Steve Baker, for instance, who is more than happy to use the government and be part of the government and push socially leftist causes as long as he can encourage policies that he thinks will make line on graph go up. And then you have the purely rights orientated libertarians, and they're probably much closer to pure libertarianism because they're looking at things through a natural rights, natural law perspective.
That's more and trying to neck of the woods,
and trying to figure out certain principles. It's kind of a bit Kantian. They kind of have an air of the categorical imperative about them, which is where I think they can go wrong, which is they try and come up with principles and rules that can apply to all situations in all times.
Yeah, I think that this is something that I have a gripe with as well, because trying to kind of extract universals out of things is always very, very difficult, because human beings are incredibly complicated things, and we've got such individual variations between one another that what might be perfectly right and ordinary for one person might be the complete opposite for someone else. And I think that applying these sorts of things blanketly over everyone is part of the reason why libertarians are anti-government in the first place. So just because you're applying your abstract principles and they're not, you know, government force, doesn't mean that the root of the problem is any different between the two things.
Yeah, and this is something that Rothbard and Hopper are pretty explicit about, that what they are doing is, well, Rothbard employs empirical examples sometimes, but a lot of what they talk about is that the method for coming up with libertarian principles and the method for libertarian economics should be purely abstract, unless there's a situation where you just can't be purely abstract. So, for instance, in Man State
in the Economy.
I think it's Man Economy and State. Oh, yeah, no, I was getting it wrong anyway. In Man Economy and State, Rothbard talks about, obviously, it's his big economic treatise, and he's talking about all of these abstract principles that he's concocted, but he does have to give leeway for one thing, and one thing alone in his system, that he has to take from empirical evidence rather than abstract theorizing, which is the idea that human beings love leisure, and leisure itself can be considered a commodity that has to be weighed up against other ones. Because purely by abstract theorizing, you would not just necessarily assume, especially when you consider the rational economic man that Mises and Rothbard were working under the assumption of, that this man is also going to potentially just want to be very lazy and sit around and do nothing all day. You're not going to take that into account. So he had to take that from his empirical observations of just the real world, that, yeah, people can be really lazy. So you do have those, but a lot of it tends to be we get first principles and then we abstract out from there.
I find that looking at things in the abstract is a very reductionist way of looking at the world, in that I would much rather look at things empirically, because actually the model of human nature that many libertarians have isn't actually very accurate, in that...
No, and this is one of my criticisms of the more purist style libertarianism.
Yeah. In that people aren't nearly as rational as many of the, especially the economists, would like to believe.
Would you like a quote just to really, really make it clear how they go wrong on human nature? And obviously this is taken from Man, Economy and State. I keep getting it wrong. I even had it right in front of me on my document here. I have been doing a lot of work recently reading through things so that I can try and come up with my good faith critique of libertarianism. And I'm still a ways to go yet, just in case anybody gets excited, because there is a lot of reading that is necessary for this. But let me see if I can find it, because in here, I was expecting, from what I'd been sold when I started reading it, and for the most part was it would be a value-free judgment of economic principles.
There are no value-free judgments.
Well, that's the thing, is that Rothbard felt the need to fit something in here anyway. Let me see if I've got all my quotes from here. I think it's from page 100. Here we go. So this is Rothbard's account from his abstract principles and theorizing of why it is that society came together in the first place. Now, you've done a lot of studying into this, so I know that you'll be able to correct where this goes wrong from your understanding of psychology and your understanding of how human societies formed in the past. So he says, an interesting aspect of this praxeological truth is that this benefit to others occurs regardless of the... Oh, wait, no, this is when he talks about... the benefits of the free market, meaning you don't have to intentionally help people to end up helping people anyway. So he says, he goes through that, and then he says, thus, in explaining the origins of society, there is no need to conjure up any mystic communion or sense of belonging among individuals. Individuals recognize, through the use of reason, the advantages of exchange resulting from the higher productivity of the division of labor, and they proceed to follow this advantageous course. In fact, it is far more likely that feelings of friendship and communion are the effects of a regime of contractual social cooperation rather than the cause. So what he's stating there is that people only form society because they ended up trading in the state of nature, Lockean sense. They were atomized individuals who ended up trading with one another, realizing there were benefits, and then forming a society as a result. Now, that might work in the group level. Groups, I reckon, probably did end up trading with each other and then assimilating as a result of the benefits.
But not at the individual level.
But not at the individual level. Yeah. And that's a big place where libertarian falls on its face for me, because that is not... One, that's not a value-free judgment. That is assuming the atomized individual state of nature. Mm. And then it is also just completely wrong. Through reading Jonathan Haidt, I learned this, and I'm sure through your own studies.
Yeah.
Human beings evolved socially. We evolved in groups, and we evolved...
We're group animals, yes.
Yeah, we evolved through that group selection to pick the people who worked best in groups were the ones who were surviving as well. Yes. So it wasn't just that we have this natural inclination, it's that through evolutionary processes, we developed even more.
This is true even of non-human primates as well. So it's not just human beings that have this proclivity, lots of primates as well. Like there are instincts in lots of apes and things like that, whereby they make sure to share food with their... is it a troop, a chimpanzee?
My chimpanzee lore.
A gang of chimps.
they're coming for you.
With their leather jackets and cigarettes in their mouth. So they're more inclined to share things out, or they release alarm signals, which obviously draw attention to them, to a predator, because they're making a loud noise. It'll draw the predator's attention, but it benefits the group as a whole. And if you look at it at a purely individual level, it doesn't necessarily make sense, but actually they're better off with the short-term risk for the long-term benefit of the group, because that is the most effective strategy to survive. So there is a certain amount of altruism baked into human nature, if you want to call it that. I mean, it still extends to self-interest.
I mean, if it was Rand saying it, she'd be spitting at you right now.
Well, I mean, altruism is more of a colloquial term to me. I think that everything relates to self-interest in some way. It's impossible to escape it.
Whereas Rand used the word altruism just as a synonym for communism. I always find that funny. But no, it is interesting, because that separates, in, if you're going to talk about the economic schools, it separates the approaches of the Chicago and the Austrian school quite nicely. The idea that the Chicagoans, and this is where they can go wrong as well, because I do think the Austrians have a point when they criticize this, being purely empirical, they take the empirical events that have happened and they try and they use that data and try and extract the principles from there. Whereas, like I say, the Austrians, they take the abstract theorizing, the first principles first, and then deduce from there the economic laws. And where the Chicagoans can go wrong through doing this is that situations and circumstances will be different in every occasion, so it can make it very difficult to actually find the principle that applies between all of these, whereas the abstracting can actually make it easier to do so.
I very much agree with that. And
then
I think
you end up with Milton Friedman in the 1960s, right before Nixon went off the gold standard, just saying outright, oh yeah, gold's barely worth anything. It's being hooked to the dollar that's making gold so valuable right now. As soon as we take it off the dollar, gold will plummet and we'll have no problem. We won't have to worry about all our gold reserves getting depleted. Take it off the dollar, bam. Gold like triples in a week.
You've triggered me just at the mention of this.
I'm sorry. I like Milton Friedman. He had a lot of good points and a lot of good things to say, but he was stupid on monetary policy. He was terrible on monetary policy.
I forgot what I was going to say now, but I think a blend of the Chicago and Austrian schools is the best, and just knowing which ones are good and which ones aren't on certain things, it's just a sort of learning experience with economics, because I think that empirical data should be good. But as you said, and this is the criticism I would have brought up of the Chicago school as well, it's very, very difficult to isolate individual principles, because when you're dealing with an entire economy, how do you isolate a principle? And how do you know whether you're controlling for all of the various factors? You can't control for what's beyond your awareness, because you're not aware of it by definition. So it's got its place, but sometimes it can be quite limited because the scope of what you're trying to explain is massive.
Yes.
Beyond your comprehension.
This is why Thomas Sowell is great, is because he comes from the Chicago background, but has also seemingly read quite a bit of Austrian economics as well. So he can kind of combine the two. Obviously, he uses a lot of empirical examples, but it's clear to me that he's taken a lot of the actual principles and laws of economics from the Austrian school. Although with Thomas Sowell, it's difficult to classify him, because I don't know if I would necessarily call him just a strict libertarian. He seems more just like a very, very, very good conservative.
He's
an excellent American.
He describes himself as conservative, doesn't he?
Yeah, but some people call him libertarian as well. I don't know if that label is completely accurate.
I think he writes
great books either way.
Yes. So I'm going to carry on with these principles, because we went on quite a good tangent, but yeah, I think quite a long
tangent
one.
Tangent was good.
But another thing is that they, libertarians specifically, rather than anarchists, do not oppose the use of force in response to initiatory aggression. Oh, sorry, this is a different point. So anarchists would agree with that.
Anarchists definitely agree with this.
So violence, fraud, theft, or trespassing, they believe violence is an appropriate response, depending on the scenario. Obviously, it's not just a blanket thing. But if someone is violent towards you, you have a right to be violent in return, which I think is actually one of the areas where libertarianism is better suited to reflect human nature than any current system or status system where the state's like, no, actually, rather than you imposing justice back on the person who victimized you, we're going to step in and impose the justice basically against your will and potentially make you pay for it by paying for the upkeep in prison, which obviously isn't great. Obviously, another one is a belief in self-sufficiency and self-responsibility and oppose things such as the welfare state, because forcing people to provide financial aid to others is a morally wrong thing, both for the individual in question psychologically and for the person whose money is being coerced out of them and given for free to the other person, which I think is a moral abomination personally. Many oppose things such as conscription because they believe no one should be forced to fight in a war they do not believe in. I don't really know how I feel about this because I can see the military strategy side of things by having the numbers. Numbers win wars. But on the other hand, I'm sympathetic to the idea that, well, making someone fight a war they don't believe in is quite immoral in and of itself. It's, so I don't know how to feel.
It's
here,
a difficult line to walk down and balance on because it is, you do have to have dual considerations, which is just the liberty of the people who you're, if you're in government, of your citizens, and then also the potential existential threats if there is, say, barbarians knocking at the door.
Mm.
But I definitely understand the critique because then you can get people like Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, forced conscription for the Union Army. I think it was the first time that anybody had ever done that in the history of the United States. Or I might be wrong there, but it was certainly a big change to what had been going on up until that point. And it got to the point where people started rioting. He sent the military after his own citizens, not in the southern states like he was doing already, but in the northern states as well. He, you know, destroyed habeas corpus. He suspended that for a long time without congressional approval. He did a lot of bad stuff, and one of the main ones was conscription, forcing people to fight in this war that they may not have necessarily believed in. A lot of people in America at the time believed in the right to secession, so they weren't too enthusiastic about fighting their southern brothers purely over the fact that Lincoln didn't like that they were trying to secede. So you can get tyrants forcing you to fight for causes that you don't care, that you don't like. The Vietnam War as well, a lot of libertarians were massively against
that.
But then if you had, say, for instance, a situation, and even this doesn't necessarily apply because we declared war on them, but in the 1930s and 1940s during World War II, for instance, when you've got people bombing your own cities, at that point I think when everybody is in such an existential threat that they're literally your home might explode one day without any warning, I think that has a much stronger argument for conscription.
I think it also affects people's willingness to fight, because if I were in the situation where I'd be conscripted for Vietnam, I would disagree with it. But if it was World War II, I think I'd be like, well, this is an existential threat to my civilization and everything I know and love. Well, I would be a coward not to fight for that.
Whereas if it's some foreign war for all the way over there against someone you're being told is an existential threat, but it's kind of more abstract because
these rice paddy farmers, they're a threat to the American way of life.
If we started getting conscripted to go and fight in Ukraine, for instance, I would not be a happy boy.
Yeah,
I would be very displeased with such an occurrence.
No, I think that that's fair. And the final one is that many believe that systems of justice should focus more on compensating the victim rather than focusing on punishment alone. For example, giving victims choices of punishments, almost like a bit of a menu, if you will, which I quite like the idea of, and financial compensation rather than the state dictating, this is the punishment and you should pay to jail this person yourself out of your taxes. So I think that that's punishing the victim twice, isn't it? Well, once for being the victim and twice for having to subsidize this person.
It depends. I do think that most people are happy to let their tax money go towards maintaining prisons as long as they know that the justice system is operational, which it certainly is not in the UK at the moment. and that the people going to prison are getting kind of their just desserts. A proportional punishment. Mm-hmm. I'm all right with the menu idea. I quite like the idea that you're at the magistrate's office or the courthouse or whatever, and they get convicted, and then some waiter comes out with a menu.
Here you are, sir.
So take some time to select your choice. We'll be here tomorrow.
Pick your method of execution.
Yeah, that would be good. As long as there is no option to let them off. Because I do worry that even if you were to get the libertarian utopia, there would still be leftist retards out there. And those people would probably be more inclined to go with the typical leftist excuses for the victim. Let's let him off this one time. I'm sure it's socioeconomic factors that led him to do this or that.
He had to mug me because he was hungry. It just so happens that he was hungry for crack, but never mind.
Yeah, exactly. You'd have those sorts of people who want to let them off, and then those criminals become empowered by knowing that if they just go for the right type of person, they're going to get off every single time.
To be fair, this is just making me want to have it, because then leftists are going to be punished, but they're going to be specifically targeted.
You know what, actually, I'm winning myself over with this argument.
You're going to be targeted for your own retardation.
This is the power that can be utilized by some abstract thinking and theorizing.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.